Good morning, Dr. Robert. I am Brahim Asiribe from the University of Perpignan, and I'm here to learn about the experiences of our team from African Americans mainly, but also Afro descent people out here. Can you just tell me who you are?
Okay, so I'm Dr. Obadile Kambon. I was born in the US in Brooklyn, North Carolina. You mentioned African Americans. Me, I'm African anti-American, so it's slightly different, meaning that since I was born, we've never stood up for the national anthem. We've never saluted the flag. We never celebrated these white holidays or anything else like that. So we're very clear on who we are as African people and black people.
Yeah. So you define yourself as African?
African anti-American.
Okay.
African anti-American.
Anti-American. Okay. And you're here since how long?
I repatriated in 2008.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For what are the reasons about you left America for Africa, especially Ghana?
Yeah, well, I came to do my PhD here at the University of Ghana. Mm-hmm. So I started that in 2009 and finished in 2012.
Yeah. And the PhD was about what subject?
Linguistics.
Linguistics.
So focusing on the Akan language of Ghana, mm-hmm. specifically.
How do you come to choose from Akan languages?
Well, my mother brought me to Ghana in 1998, and I started learning the language. She was initiated into the Akan spiritual system, as was called, in Okomfo. So my position relative to her was Ochiame. That's what they referred to as the linguist. It was more like a spokesperson. Now, I realized that to do that job well, I had to learn the language. So I came again in 1999, again with her, to what she has called the Sankofa journey. You can check it out, sankofajourney.com. That's where she brings Africans from the diaspora here to Ghana specifically.
Okay.
And her connection, of course, was through the spiritual system. Also, she came to Ghana first in 1972, which was before I was even born. And, you know, basically what she did, she brought me here. I started learning the language from the year 2000 to 2001. I did study abroad here at the University of Ghana, learning the Akan language, beginning to get even deeper into it. And then when I went back to the States, I had a class called Medunecha. That's what they call hieroglyphs. And my teacher said, oh, you're so good at these languages. You're making these connections between the ancient languages and the contemporary languages. You need to go to grad school for it. So I ended up going to grad school at University of Wisconsin-Madison. I got two masters, one in African languages and literature, one in linguistics. I started teaching Chi at the Chicago State University in Chicago. Then I came here to do my PhD in linguistics, focusing on Akan linguistics.
Okay, but you chose African language. Mm-hmm. Was that just an intellectual exercise for you, or you chose because there was a deep connection with Africa and you mm-hmm. wanted to do it because of that connection?
Yeah, I'll say because of the connections. I just mentioned that my whole reason was because of being initiated into the Akan spiritual system. So for that, it's a way of life. You understand, so we don't practice Christianity, Islam, anything else. We practice the spiritual systems of our indigenous ancestors. And the best way to understand the thought, you know, the deep thought of our ancestors is through the language, through the proverbs, through the idioms, so forth and so on.
But from being in Africa, mm-hmm. Africa have undergone like a 13 centuries of Islamic invasion and mm-hmm. 4 centuries of European domination, mm-hmm. and you see churches and mosques everywhere. How do you see that?
Yeah, I see it as a need to re-Africanize and de-whitenize. You know, so we're talking about kicking the whites out of ourselves, you know, mentally, spiritually, and economically, in every way, shape, and form. So I think it's a very horrible thing, and you know that's part of what some of us are here to do, is to help people understand that these are the religions of our enemies. You understand, you're worshiping the gods of your conquerors, imaginary white people, and that's who you're praying to. So you know, these are some of the things that we are trying to, you know, help conscientize, you know, people about.
So you are a teacher. Do you have formal programs, formal of de-whitening or problem of bringing consciousness of black love in Ghana, in Accra here?
Yeah, I would say even some of the pushback is from people who are otherwise you know, at least African on the outside in their skin, mm-hmm. but they've gotten so used to these white religions, white philosophies, white ideologies, that they will be the first ones who will try to push back against something mm-hmm. like this. Other than that, you know, people, the general populace seems to be very ripe for it, you understand, because they say, how come we spent all of our lives and we never learned anything about Africa? We can tell you about Queen Victoria and Napoleon and all these random white, Einstein, all these random white people. We know nothing about ourselves as African people. You know, even to a degree, the few who do, it tends to be, oh, I know about my own ethnic group. It's not African consciousness. And then the few who tend to have any type of what you may call African consciousness, it's not a real African consciousness. It's more like, let's unite with Arabs or Dutch Boers in South Africa or anyone who happens to be on the African continent, and not the original idea of Pan-Africanism, which is around black people, no matter where we're located. Yeah.
And from embracing Africa this way, some people may be tempted to say that it's kind of a racism in a way. How do you see that view?
If the main reason why that idea is out there is to prevent African people from thinking things that are beneficial to ourselves. You understand? So as long as you're caught up in this paralysis of analysis of, oh, well, what will somebody say? Who cares? We're doing what's beneficial for African people, first and foremost. Whatever anybody wants to say, usually they're trying to say it as a means of self-defense. You understand? If I want to make sure that you... So let's look at these white Eurasians, Europe and Asia, looking at them as one entity. If they come here and then they say, oh, you know, if you try to defend yourself against us as racism, it's insanity, you know, and it's very transparent. But some people, they say, oh no, we don't want to be racist, come and rape our resources, come steal our land, come, you know, do whatever you want to do just so you won't call us whatever. And you know, it's almost childish, but look at how many people go for this thing. So, you know, at a certain point, we have to say, who cares what they say? We're doing what's necessary for African people, for the uplift of African people.
On the other side, you can see some Afro-descendant people and African-Americans claiming that they have nothing to do with Africa. Mm-hmm. How do you see these kind of claims?
So this is the whole reason why the term African-American came about, because before that, we were calling ourselves black. Now, if you understand yourself as black, it's the broadest possible identity. It means that if you have black people in Cuba, they're also the same thing as you are. If you have black people in Brazil, look, they're the same thing as you are. Black people in Ghana, they're the same thing as you are. Black people in Pacific Islands, same thing as you are. So one of the main popularizers of this term African-American, basically it's an idea to get people to become fragments, you understand, so you don't see yourself as connected to other black people. You see yourself as a teeny tiny fragment, you understand? So all these things, Afro-Brazilian, Afro-Cuban, Afro-Peruvian, Afro whatever you want to call it, all of these things are, again, just the same divide and conquer as they had at the Berlin Conference, to make me think I'm different from you, to make you think. So me, I never use this term African-American, ever, ever. To me, it's one of the worst insults possible. But then by the same token, look at the fragments that we have here on the continent. It's the same thing as saying Ghanaian, Nigerian. You didn't decide these boundaries, not you specifically, but none of us as African people decide these boundaries, but we're still running along with this thing. That was decided at the Berlin Conference, where they invited Russia, Italy, Belgium, so forth and so on. They didn't invite any black people there, but now we're still into these fragmented identities, which are there ultimately to serve the interests of our enemies. Yeah.
And being here, for example, in Ghana, how was the integration, for example? There was, for example, language barriers,
I didn't have any language barriers, because that's the method by which I started even coming to Ghana. Mm. So, you know, right now I teach Pi at the university to Ghanaians, so, you know, I don't have the issue. For most folks who come from the States, they... have what I would say possibly a block from learning the language, where they decide either consciously or subconsciously that they're not going to learn another language. So for a lot of people, it's like they're here physically, but they really aren't here on other levels, especially linguistic levels. Well, for me, I definitely did not have that situation. And my colleagues, if they want to know the word for something in Chi, I'm the one who they come to. Yeah.
And from me myself living from in Europe, you can see from the different approach of life in Europe. The capitalist, everybody is rushing in a way. Mm. When you came here first, do you have rumble that kind of clash of the way? Because in Africa, things sometimes you hear that things are slow from the point of view of people living from on the Western world.
Yeah, you know, as you bring up the capitalist, communist, socialist, or whatever, to me, I don't look at the world in those types of dichotomies. I really see them as false dichotomies, where basically, again, for the interests of white people, they do something like what you would call good cop, bad cop. And when we say good cop, bad cop, it's something like, here you have two people who want to arrest you. One is treating you nicely, the other one is treating you mean. The one beats you, he hits you, kicks you, blah, blah, blah. And then the other one comes and says, oh, sorry about that. Would you like something to eat? Now you start to befriend this one as though they're not after the same objective. Both of them want to lock you underneath the prison, but because you don't understand it. So this is basically what we're dealing with when we're talking about white capitalists, a white socialist, a white communist. None of them are our friends. All of them want their own, you know, self-protection. They want their own self-preservation and things of this nature. So, you know, but to come pointed to your question about, you know, the pace, I grew up in the south of the United States, so it's about as African as you can get while you're over there. So things are very slow. People give directions the same way they do here. Or go around the corner and you'll see somebody standing there. So it's a similar type of situation. People greet each other in the morning and things of that nature. Mm. My father grew up in New York, and he said when he first moved, actually my mother told me when he first moved down to the South, that people he didn't know would just wave at him, and he thought there was like a conspiracy, like, why are you waving at me? Because in New York, you know, everybody's kind of to themselves, and you know, if you know me, fine, why are you looking at me if you don't know me? But, you know, there, everybody greets. It's still very much of an African vibe. At least that's how it was when I was still growing up.
And since I'm here in the month of May, and I've seen for different people from Jamaica, from the United States. But on the other side, you see African applying to go to Europe and to go to the United States. How do you see that dynamic?
Very good. So I see it as what I call manipulated migration. So when I think about, you know, the population of the world and migration and things of that nature, the very first migration is the ancient voluntary migration. So here we're talking about 60,000 to 80,000 years ago, the very first populations of Africans went out to populate the rest of the world. And you still find people who are phenotypically African from that point in time, specifically in Pacific Islands, Australia, all the way as far away as Hawaii. You have indigenous black people from there. And then we come to the recent forced migration. This is what we usually think of when we talk about people who are elsewhere. That's, you know, trans-Saharan, transatlantic, what's referred to as Maafa or Maangamizi or Neshni, all these terms that have been proposed to describe this catastrophe that white people have done to black people. And that's on the scale, the first one is on the scale of thousands of years. This second one is on the scale of hundreds of years. And then you have the current manipulated migration. And what this is where these same white people who have been enemies to African people in the past continue to be so now, and for all intents and purposes seem like they will continue to be so in the future, that they foment rebel groups or they do coup d'etats. But they destroy our economies through IMF, World Bank policies, neoliberalism, all these things, whatever you want to call it. So after they destroy your country, now you want to go somewhere else. You understand? So they've manipulated your choices. You think, oh, I just happen to want to be in Italy. But who destroyed your country to the point where, you know, you want to leave the place where your ancestors are buried, where your mother and father are, where all of your family is? So I see it in terms of anything you look at, you can think about who originates it and who benefits from it. You understand? So if you see someone who is benefiting from what's often referred to as brain drain, most likely that's the same people who created that brain drain situation in the first place. So if there are more doctors outside of Ghana, Ghanaian doctors outside of Ghana, than there are in Ghana, you have to start thinking of who benefits from that. Well, the UK, most of them are there, others are in America. Well, what did they do to Ghana in order to make that situation pertain so that they would get the benefits? Then we start going into the role of the CIA and the overthrow of Kwame Nkrumah, all these things that we can look at and point to and see very clearly cause and effect, cause and effect. So that's how I look at any phenomenon. If you want to trace back, if all I know is somebody benefits from it, if I follow the money trail, most likely I'll find out that that's who originated it. Or vice versa, if all I know is that you originated this thing called the Berlin Conference, then if I look at all of these subsequent effects of these borders and all these other things, then I can see who benefits from it, you understand? And the same thing for any ideology, whether it's Marxism or communism or capitalism. If these are ideas that are coming from white people, they're creating things with the intent that they will benefit from what they create. You understand? It's not intended for me to have a dog and then have the dog bite me. I'm training this dog to go and bite other people. You understand? So that's the situation.
Yeah. Now going on to the past, to the Middle Passage, how do you see in your memory the Middle Passage, the boats in no man's land on the ocean?
Mm-hmm. How do I see them?
Yeah.
Well, the largest graveyard in the history of the planet Earth is in what's referred to as the Atlantic Ocean, which has gone under other names, Ethiopian Ocean, so forth and so on. That I see this as two things. There's a book called Exchanging Our Country Marks, I want to say, by Michael Gomez. Basically what he deals with there is you go from people who call themselves all types of fragments to eventually call themselves one thing. So before, I may call myself Ewe, you all are Ga, you guys over there, you all are Sante, or Akan in general, Denshira, whatever. You all up there, you are Dagbangba, you know, Dagare. But once you're on the ships, you realize, look, none of those divisions matter. Here is all of us who are underneath, and we're all black, and all of them up top, and they're all white. So once you get to that other side, look at Haiti, they didn't say, oh, we're only going to have the airways come and do this uprising, or only the phone can participate in this uprising, only the Bakongo can. They said, look, we're all black and we're in the same boat. So it makes sense for us to unite around what we have in common in order to defeat this common enemy. So, you know, I look at it on that level in terms of all of us come together and realize, look, we're all black. We're on this side of the chessboard. Look at them on that side of the chessboard. You have to fight against them. And that's one of the, what I could say, perhaps unintended consequences of it. And this is even with the rise of, to go back to what we were discussing before, the term African-American or Afro-Brazilian or Afro-Cuban or Black British or all these things, is that, you know, there was an understanding of how powerful this transformation was, that look, we're all black, let's unite economically, let's unite militarily, let's unite in every single way, shape, and form to defeat our enemies. Well, that's scary because they saw what happened in Haiti, and you know, they said Haiti can be all over the planet, so that's even why they oppress Haiti to this day, because they see how powerful that example was. So that's as they're coming to this idea of, look at all these black people who understand they're black, we need to chop them up and then make it so that Africans in the diaspora don't get along with Africans on the continent. So look at the images that they send in movies and on TV. Those in the diaspora look at the continent and say, oh, it's Ebola, it's AIDS, you know, it's poverty, it's warlords, it's corruption. I don't want to have anything to do with it, which means we never actually sit down to talk with those people. And then look at the images that they send here to the continent. They'll say it's Bloods and Crips and drug dealers and gangbangers and blah, blah, blah. So at the end of the day, continental Africa said, we don't want to have anything to do with those black people over there. You understand? Much less even within, Ghanaians don't like Nigerians, and you can just go ad infinitum. Over there, you know, Jamaicans and black Americans or whatever you want to call them don't get along. So it's all this stuff, but again, you can look at who benefits from those things. So to come back to, you know, the Middle Passage, as you call it, I don't like that term because it sounds like a pleasure cruise. Hey, I'm on the Middle Passage, let's relax, you know. That's one of the fallouts of it, is an understanding that, look, we're all black people and we have common enemies. Now, once you start going into the history, you come to see that these common enemies have been our enemies for over 5,400 years of recorded history. So in Kemet, what they call ancient Egypt, all of our black ancestors wrote down time and time again in the prophecies of Nefertiti, and the instructions to Merikari, and the lamentations of Ipuwer, and Sanhat, all these texts about, look at these white folks here, they're our enemies. We need to build a wall to keep them out. If they come in, we need to expel them. They were very clear. They even explaining the reason why. They say, look at how miserable they are. You know, because they have little resources, that's why they're like thieves. That's why they're, you know, so cold hearted and so forth and so on. So, you know, that's also part of the reason why they don't want us to know our own history. If they can say your history started when the first white man set foot in West Africa, then that's all you start from. But once you get a background of what the actual history was, then you can say, this is the same thing. I was just reading an article about this Libyan so-called warlord who kidnaps continental Africans from Somalia, Sudan, and everywhere else who try to pass through Libya in order to go to the Mediterranean and then go serve their white masters. And, you know, what he does, he, if they can't pay a ransom, he kills them, or he sells them into slavery, all so forth and so on. Now, just because black people don't know this ancient history between us and these Arabs, it doesn't mean that nobody else does. So they look at us and they say, oh, that's my same enemy from 3,000, 4,000 years ago. And it's like an ostrich. You're walking around with your head in the sand. You say, oh, you won't recognize. Yeah, we see you. You're the same guy we've been fighting with for 4,000 years. Just because you don't know, that doesn't mean, let's say somebody has a grudge against you. You know, maybe you all fought before, and he says, next time I see this guy, I'm going to punch him in the face. Now, if something happens to you, you get amnesia. You don't even remember. So you're just walking down the street. Here's your enemy. He's scowling at you. He's balling up his fist. And he's just walking oblivious. When he sees you, guess what? He knows that history, even if you forgot that history. Well, this is part of the reason why we're not taught our history and why we don't learn how to read. You know, we talk about how African people invented writing, mathematics, and so forth and so on. But it's not enough to just pat yourself on the back and say, look, we did great things in the past. If you invented writing, what did you write down? Do you understand? We were writing things down just so us, the descendants, would have them available, have that information available, and understand this is how we need to do, this is how we need to not do. This was a mistake. This was, you know, something that was beneficial. All of this is the historical record, which stretches back, again, 5,400 plus years. You understand? So once we access that, then we'll be unlike the person with amnesia. This guy comes up. I say, I know exactly who this guy is. Otherwise, we don't understand anything. We'll say, oh, this Libyan warlord, why is he treating us so cruelly? Oh, we don't understand. Oh, you understand? That's the situation.
You said that you don't like the terms are Middle Passage.
Yeah.
How, in your own terms, how do you want to?
There's actually an author named Walimo Baruti who consulted me on other terminology that we can use. So one that I suggested in Tree was Entoracio Tuco, which translates to a genocidal forced migration.
Okay.
Genocidal forced migration. And then this is even looking at, if you look at definitions of genocide, forcibly transferring children of a group from one place to another, you know, bringing about conditions to bring about the destruction in whole or in part of a group, you know, all these things, you look at all these point for point, we definitely qualify for genocide, you know, any of these, either during that point in time or right now. So I actually wrote an article a couple of years ago about how the 13th Amendment, that slavery has never been abolished in the U.S., because according to the 13th Amendment, it says that servitude, slavery or servitude shall not exist except as punishment of a crime. They were sure to put in except so that they can keep getting free labor from black people, African people. They said they built their whole thing based on free labor and they don't plan on stopping anytime soon. So even now, they arrest black people. They say, all of you are criminals. Then they arrest you. And guess what? You're back to working for free for them just like you were. And even now, there are more in these privatized prisons, more black people in these privatized prisons, and the whole prison industrial complex in general, than were in the border states in 1865. You understand? So this gives us an understanding of the magnitude. And not a new thing, that right after enslavement, the chattel enslavement, they went straight to convict leasing. this is where they would arrest you, and then they sell you off or lease you off to a company that has the right to work you to death. So they would trump up any charge and say, you're sitting there, where's your proof of employment? You say, oh well, you're under arrest. Now you have to go, you know, make turpentine out of pine trees. You have to go dig coal 3 tons a day. And literally they will work you to death. And what they said, one of the prison guards said, was interviewed at that time. He said, this is even better than slavery. In slavery, you have to take care of them even if they're not working in the winter or whenever. Here, all you have to do is arrest one, and if he dies, you just go arrest somebody else. So there's no incentive to even take care, like they, even though they weren't taking good care during enslavement, they were whipping, killing, rape, and murder. But there, it's even less incentive, and that's what's persisted up to this day, because after the convict leasing, then they had debt peonage. If they can show that you're in debt, now they can again get you back on the farm, harvesting cotton for free, so forth and so on, sharecropping. Now, even when I grew up in the late 70s, I was born in 79, early 80s, I grew up in North Carolina, this is in the south of the U.S., there was still a family right across the road from us who was still sharecropping. You understand, this is the exact same situation. And right after the sharecropping, now they have what they call privatized prisons, where they say, oh, you're a gang member. No, I have a job. No, you're a gang member. Now, you can either spend $10,000 to fight the charge that they just came up with on a whim, or if you don't have that, guess what? You're going to prison with everybody else, and you're going to make computers. So Dell, Compaq, HP, which are linked, all of these are corporations, Microsoft, Sony, all of them are deep into the privatized prisons and the prison industrial complex. So what they do is that, you know, for example, if you have a Sony Records or whatever, they'll produce all types of gangster music to make you glorify being a criminal. Then once you actually act on that criminality, they say, good, now you'll be making the records for us in the prison.
So till 2017, citizenship of African Americans is something that can be taken away, or that's not granted.
Citizenship, you're talking about in the U.S.?
Yeah, citizenship of African Americans in America.
Yeah, you know, even as people have ever talked about citizenship in relation to black people, they've referred to it as second-class citizenship, third-class citizenship, because let's say you are a citizen, you know, you always salute the flag or you do whatever you do, that you're walking down the street, they shoot you in the head. What kind of citizenship is that? You understand? Or, you know, there was this case, and these are just some of the ones that have come to light in the news, of this Oklahoma police officer who would arrest black women and then rape them in the back of his squad car, or he would trace them down later and force them to perform oral sex in their own house, all these types of things. You know, what type of citizenship do you really have? Just a week or two ago, I was looking at a video where they had a black man and a white man. The white man was walking down in an open carry state where it's supposedly legal for you to carry a weapon out in the open. The police comes up to him and says, oh, can you show me your ID? No, I don't have to show you ID. This is a free state. I can do what I want. He just cursing the cop out. The black man walks down the same street in the same place. And the police don't even ask him a question. They come out and pull the guns. Get down on the ground. Get down on the ground now. You know, and his pregnant wife is with him. You two, get down on your belly. I'm pregnant. I don't care. Get down on your effing belly. What type of citizenship do you have? So to say it's been taken away is a misnomer, because it's assuming that you even had it in the first place. You understand?
Okay. But from what you said at the beginning,
I think I have to go to my meeting, because they'll probably be...
Pause.
Yeah?
Okay. Okay. So we were talking about the middle passage, and now we can switch to the integration here. I want to know how you work with Ghanaian government for citizenship or owning lands in Ghana.
Yeah, recently I was one of 34 Africans from the diaspora who got Ghanaian citizenship. That's the first time it's been done, you know, in that way for a group, where actually the former president, John Dramani Mahama, personally came to the ceremony and handed us our certificate, shook our hands. So, you know, that of course is not, you know, regular. They have whoever, deputy, someone, minister of interior, deputy or judge. But he thought it was so significant that he actually wanted to be there in person to, as he referred to it, restore our citizenship. So the video of that is online. It will definitely be worth you checking it out if you get a chance. Now, there's also a development policy. It's supposed to be, I want to say, a 40-year policy where, you know, regardless of what government happens to be in power, that they're looking at extending out to the diaspora. Now, one of the challenges is that, like many other concepts, the term diaspora has been sort of hijacked. So they're saying Ghanaian diaspora and not African diaspora. So that just means Ghanaians who are on vacation in London somewhere, that's the diaspora. We got to get the diaspora back. Now, some are of the opinion that the reason why there's such a push to hijack this term diaspora is to sidetrack some of the claims of the actual diaspora, including reparations, including all these types of things. So they want to say, oh no, if we can limit it to Ghanaians on vacation, then we don't have to worry about reparations, apologies, or especially that, because that's the money side, you know. Yeah. So that's one of the challenges, is just, you know, keeping people from hijacking terms like diaspora, hijacking terms like Pan-Africanism, where initially it applied to black people no matter where they are. And you have people who've hijacked it to mean whoever happens to be on the African continent. So that means the original Arab imperialist invaders in North Africa. That means the Dutch Boers in South Africa and the British or whoever else happens to be here. And that's not what it was about. So, you know, just in terms of keeping the sanctity of terminology so that we can actually do things that are beneficial to black people, which is synonymous with African people and vice versa. Other things, you know, in terms of integrating, the main thing was citizenship, but along with the policy that we had input in was concerns about right to return, a right to own land, to do business without having to pay this astronomical, I think it's somewhere around $200,000 just to get any type of business going, and you have to, of course, have a Ghanaian in there as well, so forth and so on. When you come, you know, they say, okay, to get citizenship. When I first came, they said it was 5 years. I went there on the day of 5 years. They said, no, 7 years now. I went at 7 years there. Oh, no, it's whatever it is now. So a lot of these things seem like needless hurdles. And for many people who haven't mastered the language, one of the hurdles is you have to know an African language, even though you have Ghanaians here who are native-born Ghanaians but don't know any African language, and some don't even speak to their children in any African language. So the children grow up only with like a choppy pidgin English type of thing. But that's what they apply to people of the diaspora, but they're not kicking out any Ghanaians because they don't speak any African language. That's one of the ones that I actually would like to see Africans from the diaspora come and make an effort to learn indigenous African languages. But, you know, where it comes to this type of policy of reintegration, that, you know, when it's stacked with all these other requirements, it just seems like hurdles that are, you know, put up to prevent, you know, Pan-Africanism in its real, truest sense from actually being implemented.
So you said that you want to push on to decide that all Ghanaians and Africans to learn their language. Is that a way from you to contribute to Africa? How, for example, you see returnees here contributing to the development of Ghana, specifically in Africa at large?
Yeah. One of the main things is, you know, to bring about an understanding of the need for black power, of black people coming together to defend ourselves, you know, to pursue interests economically and in other areas. Now, what you have here, and I remember hearing this way back in the 90s, people would be like, oh, our problem here is tribalism. And, you know, to some degree, you can see that, you know, Asantes don't like Ewes, Ewes don't like Gaz, and Gaz don't like Asantes, and Fantes don't like anybody. It's like all this stuff. And at the end of the day, no one on the planet thinks about anybody like this. Like, nobody can even tell the difference. I remember with the violence in South Africa, where they were killing and beating up people from Zimbabwe and Mozambique and other places, that people were like commenting on the video like, who's who? which one is this? Because nobody, you know, they're like, all of y'all are black people and we treat all of you the same. So you get somebody from South Africa who goes to, say, Germany, the police will burn you alive, just like they'll do somebody from Congo, just like they're like, all of y'all are black people to us. So it behooves us to really have, you know, how can we defend our interests collectively? Yeah. You know, you had at the Berlin conference all these different Eurasians coming together, Russia, the U.S., white folks in the U.S., Italy, you know, Belgium, Germany, of course, UK, Portugal, all of them were coming together to say, look, we're pursuing our interests together. And even if you look at, you know, somebody like Hitler, the main issue that Europeans have with Hitler is that they had made a decision that they would only do things like that to black people. So the fact that you're doing these things, genocide and other things to white people, that's their actual issue. Because they were doing at the same time, look at, you know, Leopold in Belgium, no outcry about that. Look at the people of Tasmania who are exterminated from the face of the earth, you understand? No outcry about any of these things. The outcry is, hold on, you're not supposed to do that with white people per our agreement. You can do it to anybody else, but don't do it to white folks. So, you know, just for us to, you know, get a better perspective and a understanding of what my father calls the global chessboard, you understand? This is how it's lined up. You better, you know, understand how it is, otherwise you'll be a victim to it, and this is exactly where we are right now. So oftentimes when I discuss this issue, I look at Africans out of the diaspora being very heavy on levels of consciousness, understanding, historical understanding who the enemy is, especially. And that tends to be lacking on this side. Meanwhile, and again, I'm very generalizing, then on this side, you have people who tend to be heavier in terms of the actual nuts and bolts of how to be free. So up at Mampo, I have a guy who's working for me who knows how to build a house out of mud bricks. Like, he can literally take an empty clearing and make a structure out of it, and he's been doing this his whole life. You know, you have people who can grow their own food. You got people who can do all of these skills that you actually need to build a nation. And that tends to be heavy here, whereas light in the diaspora. So all on that side, you have people who can run down, oh, this was the most ancient this. We wrote this. They know the history. They know on what date this occurred, blah, blah. You ask people here, your general person may not know that type of information. But basically what I see is a coming together of those two. You know, now it's usually termed in terms of like the practical side with the more theoretical side. And usually that's presented as like a debate between Booker T. Washington, Marcus Garvey, that lineage and on one side, and then your Du Bois, Alain Locke, and other people on the other side. So some are saying, let's do practical things so that we can run our own nation. Other people are saying, oh, if we can only do stuff with our hands and not with our minds, then we'll always be somebody's slave. But imagine if you can bring those two together. And this is really the import of images that we get, movies, TV shows, to keep us away from even just sitting down and talking to each other. Because once we do, then we say, you know what, I've been manipulated to think this, this, and this about you. I never want to talk to you. Then on that side, they'll say, oh, well, I was told that this, this, this about you. I would never have wanted to talk to you. Why and whose interest is it to make us not want to talk to each other? So, you know, I think that if we can bring about that coming together, then we will have really accomplished something.
From at the beginning of the question, you mm-hmm. said that you said the word reparation. Mm-hmm. Do you think that granting citizenship to the returnees is a kind of a reparation from Ghana, from the parts of Ghana, Ghana's government, or in part of African government too?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a good question. When we talk about reparations, basically you're looking at the root word for to repair. Ghana's government wasn't in existence at the time that the damage was being done. There was no such thing as a Ghana. So for them to do reparation as a government of Ghana, it's kind of like, okay, somebody stole my thing and now somebody else is, you know, going to take responsibility for it. I think we have to look at mainly the white folks who were behind the enslavement of African people and then manipulated people who didn't see themselves as Africans and didn't know that they were all in the same boat ultimately in order to serve out those agendas. If you look at every single ship, there wasn't a single ship that was owned by African people. That gives you an idea of the balance of power. If you look at how built up, you know, these white countries are as opposed to African countries, that gives you an idea of what was actually going on. Now you have this whole stream of thought from Skip Gates and all these types of folks who are like, no, let's blame African people. The problem is those people did not at that time and still didn't understand that they were all Africans. If they did, then we wouldn't have had this problem in the first place. So, you know, we really have to get some type of clarity on who our actual enemies are. Otherwise, at the end of the day, we do something that still benefits these white folks at the end of the day, which is still beating up other black people. So then we say, continental Africans, we're mad at you. They say, well, diaspora Africans, we're mad at you. Then we beat each other up. And then the white folks laugh all the way to the bank because they still own all the platinum mines, all the uranium mines, all the gold, all the diamonds. And at the end of the day, what did we accomplish? We just beat each other up some more, which is what we were doing at the time of enslavement, beating each other up for the ultimate benefit of white folks. So we have to put these things in perspective, I think.
Okay. From granting citizenship to returnees, especially African Americans, considering them in a global diaspora of African diaspora, do you think that it's really something linked to the deep love of African at large, or it's something very something political from the side of nowadays governments in Africa?
So it's a good question, and I really can't speak for somebody else because I don't know what they're thinking. And what was said, and again, I would encourage you to look at the video from the president. He says that what he's doing is restoring what's already ours. He says, don't look at it like I'm giving you anything. I'm not giving you anything. I'm restoring back what was rightfully yours, your birthright. And, you know, this was the type of terminology that he used. So, you know, for my part, I can judge based on what he said. At that point in time, he was already voted out, so he didn't serve to benefit any way, shape, or form politically, at least not in the immediate future. Maybe he says, oh, 50 years down the line, one of these people who I gave citizenship is going to vote for me. I'll get 34 more votes, hopefully. But it's really, at that point in time, at least, it was more symbolic than, okay, I'm going to give 30 million citizenships, then I get the majority. That's something that I could see as very much more political. And a lot of these people, you know, the presidents and those who are higher up, have had at least some type of background and understanding. You know, some of them are historians by training and things of that nature. So, you know, they at least have some level of understanding of what went on and, you know, the import and impact of that. So, you know, what I see is them actually acting on whatever knowledge is out there that, you know, they're aware of.
Yeah. And now I'm going to ask you the last question. Due to, for example, the difference in skin color, you can see that people coming from outside here have more... the skin color is not very deep like Ghanaian or like African in a way, and the way they speak English is different, and sometimes they even get called Abroni. We can say that perhaps that they don't know their sons who has been taken away from Africa, but what are you doing, for example, to make them know that African Americans are not very distant that way, that they are part of Africa?
Well, one thing I do from that side is to discourage people from using the term African-American. So that in and of itself, as I mentioned before, is a very divisive type of thing that's designed to make folks anywhere see you as you're just one tiny fragment over there. If we can come to a level of understanding that, look, we're all black people, that equals African, we're all African, that equals black people. There are songs, as long as you're a black man, you're African, all these types of ideas. So that's one. On the other side, we actually had a panel a couple of years ago, what is the word Obruni and what does it mean to Ghanaians? So we had Africans from the diaspora, continent, you know, all coming together to discuss this issue and, you know, basically give points of view when you say this. Now, the ironic thing is people don't want to be called Obruni, but then they have the term American, which is naming yourself after a white man, Amerigo Vespucci, that's a white man. So you're like, okay, I don't mind being called after a white man as long as it's in English. Just don't call me after a white man in Chi. And it's like, you don't want to use an African language to do something, but you're fine with using a European language to call yourself a white person. So, you know, I think a lot of it is a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding. When somebody here would do that for whatever reason, and luckily I'm dark enough that I never get called Obruni anywhere. I think part of it is just people being educated, and it goes to both sides, because you can have a continental African who goes to the U.S., for example, and everybody will say, look, that's an African booty scratcher. And they'll start laughing and ha ha ha, call somebody African, it's time to fight. Because again, you have this constant pounding of images that Africa is negative. Being black is bad, that's negative. We need to perm our hair to look like a horse or a dog. We need to bleach our skin to look like a shaved pig. You understand? There's a quote from Malcolm X, and to paraphrase, he says, who taught you to hate yourself? Who taught you to hate the kinkiness of your hair, the thickness of your lips, the broadness of your nose, the color of your skin? Who taught you to hate yourself from the very top of your head to the soles of your feet? Before you ask me if I'm teaching hate, ask yourself, who taught you to hate what the Creator made you to be? And again, that's a paraphrase, but that's all the points he made, basically. That this is really what we're dealing with, is, you know, this understanding of, you know, who are we as black people, as African people. Now, the other side is that you have people who are compromised in various ways, either genetically, biologically, ideologically, religiously, socially. And when I say compromised, I mean that they've had an injection of whiteness into them. Now, let's say from the ideological level, let's say you're black, but all of your thinking is named after a white man named Marx. You understand? Then you've been compromised. That means that instead of looking out for the interests of black people, you're looking out for white folks like Marx. You'll never come up with an idea that would do anything to harm your white ideological father. Same thing we could look if you have a biological father or mother. That oftentimes the challenges occur where somebody may have one parent who's white and one parent who's black. And they're like, oh, you know, I'm down for black people, but don't do anything to hurt my white mama. So, you know, it's a bit of a quandary for them. Now, some people are able to, you know, go beyond that and say, oh, you know, I'm down with my black side. But there's always that side, which is the reason why all these things are created. If you see that they've given you Christianity, you have to, again, think about who's originating this and who benefits from it. If they're giving you Christianity, what do they plan on getting out of it? But what you see around is what they get out of it is that you get all these black people worshiping an image of an imaginary white man. You understand? You get, if you have somebody who's, you know, miscegenating the black race, what do they get out of it? Well, now they get all these little confused children who are like, oh, don't hurt my white mama. No. We need to be about what is beneficial for black people, not worried about what your white mama thinks or what your white ideological father or this white Jesus, your white spiritual father, all these things. They keep dumping your white educational father. They keep dumping all these things and injecting them into you so that you can have always a watering down. You never get people who say, oh, I'm down with the black cause and that's what it's about. You always get people who have this, compromise type of position, right? So, you know, I think that's part of the challenge as well, beyond just the name and the label, is getting at the heart of re-Africanization and de-whitenization. Now, it's easier, and again, I hear this from people who try, it's easier to try to work on re-Africanizing than it is to get to de-whitenizing, because when you're dealing with de-whitenizing, you're talking about cutting out things, you understand? So whether it's the holidays that you were grown up celebrating, whether it's the clothes that you wear, whether it's the name that you respond to, all these things, you know, it's like, wow, I've been answering to this name for 30 years. I'm not ready to stop calling me whatever. So, you know, these are some of the challenges that I think are there. But I think there are challenges that have to be confronted so that we can move forward as African black people.
So you just said that the name, and your name is Obadele. Did you change your name or?
No, I was born with my name. And every time I get continental Africans asking me, did I change my name? And they have white names or Arab names. That, you know, part of the history is that several generations ago, for some of us, you have people who said, we're not white, why do we have white names? You understand? So I was born with an African name. All of my siblings have African names. We've never had any white names. You come to the continent, you have people who've never had any African name. You know, sometimes you get kids where both the first name and the last name are either French or Arabic or something else. But, you know, this is what we would come to understand once we all sit down at the table. You understand, well, how come you only have African names? And usually the way that we do it in the diaspora is different from here, because when we're saying we're re-Africanized, we're talking about all of Africa. So you may have somebody with one name from Nigeria, another name from Tanzania, another name from South Africa. That's because we see ourselves as African, not, oh, I'm this specific ethnic group, you understand? Whereas here, if you have somebody who says, oh, I'm going to re-Africanize, I'm Akan, I'm going to go back to my village and have three Akan names. And it's like, that's really not African in the broader sense. You're re-Akanizing, but you're not doing anything in terms of all African people, all black people. And I actually want to do a study. I've started working on it in terms of looking at names and what names tell us about the state of Pan-Africanism. Now, one thing I discuss is that here on the continent, there tends to be what I call a backwards forwards paradigm, where I'm interested in going forwards towards the UK or France, or backwards towards my village, and that's all we know about. Either I can tell you about Queen Victoria, or I'll say Tutu, and that's all I know. But once we really understand we're supposed to be in African studies, once we really understand what we are as African people, then we start looking at, well, Imhotep, right? He didn't come from my village, but this is the world's first multi-genius. He's black, he's African, therefore that's mine. Or we start learning Wolof, because, all right, I'm African, that's an African language, that's my language. When you talk to people on the ground, they say, oh, I don't speak Chi, that's not my language. This lets you know that they have no African consciousness. Whereas from somebody somewhere else may have the idea that Ga's my language and Ewe is my, I wasn't born speaking any of them. Chi is also my language. Dagbanli is also my language. Wolof is my language. Krobo is my language. You understand? That's when you actually have real functional African people, really functional Africanness from that intentionality side. Not just, oh, I happen to speak these languages because I happen to have been born somewhere. But where's the level of consciousness that is the driving factor, the motivating factor? Because if that's not there, then just as easily as you may have picked these up, you say, okay, well, I'm just Portuguese too and French too and whatever. There's no organizing principles that go along with it. There's no evaluative criteria that goes along with it. There's no way to prevent what I call sociocultural AIDS, which is that anything can come in and you don't have the immune system to block it and keep it out. You understand? But I think that that's what we need as African people, because like my father often says, that all of us have a little white agent that's been implanted into us, usually through commercials and through the miseducational system and through the religious system. All these things, again, it just injects this little white conscience into you, where if you do something that's good for black people, oh no, that white conscience doesn't like that. And there's a scholar named Amos Wilson, psychologist, who talks about the issues that we suffer from is very similar to multiple personality disorder or spirit possession, in the sense that, you know, once you have something that creates tastes and desires inside of you, then it wants to feed its tastes and desires whether or not it's good for the host body or not. So you talk about, you know, here's multiple personality disorder, this one smokes, that's destroying the lungs. But then, you know, another personality comes, this one doesn't smoke. You understand? That when you have this other consciousness inside of you, it does what it needs, it does what it wants, it fulfills its own desires. Now, the oldest book in the history of the world, Instructions of Ptahhotep, oldest surviving text, because we wrote as African people some before that, is that one who listens to his belly belongs to the enemy. One who listens to his belly belongs to the enemy. That means if somebody who's your enemy can create these tastes and desires inside of you, you just think you're making choices without realizing that it's the 5,000 Coca-Cola billboards that's making you just happen to want Coke right now, without realizing that it's the Michael Jordan flying through the air since you were 5 years old that makes you just happen to want to wear Nikes right now. That once you can understand this, then you realize, look, there's this little white guy inside of me who's everything he wants to do enriches my enemy. Because now I got to send $100 to Nike. Now I got to send, you know, $1,000 to, you know, this. I got to buy this Mercedes-Benz car. I don't want an African-made one. I want this. So all of these things, you know, tie back into what's really the core of it, which is self-love. And European, when I say Europe, I should say Eurasian, because Europe and Asia are just one continent. Even though they try to tell you Europe is different, you can look on the map and say, no, it's just one thing. So whether it's the Chinese who are doing galamsey and destroying our environment, whether it's the Germans, whether it's the Dutch, whether it's whoever, all of them are very clear that they are down for self-preservation. They want to preserve themselves. And what that means for us as African people is we also need to be trying to preserve ourselves, defend ourselves, fight for ourselves, look out for what's beneficial for black people, regardless of where we are in the world, whether it's in Haiti, Cuba, India, because there are black people who founded that civilization, the Indus Kush civilization, as they call it, Dravidian civilization, as they call it. There are black people in the Pacific Islands, black people in Australia. So once we understand what we really have is a super state, if we can conceptualize it as such, where if we can all come together, look at all the resources that we have. Now we need to start thinking about development as how do we defend those resources? How do we defend our lives? But it requires that level of consciousness. Otherwise, it's like you're all fragmented. You understand? It's like being schizophrenic where this part of the mind doesn't work with this part of the mind. You understand? So imagine if this is my left hand and here's somebody who wants to come beat me up, but the right hand doesn't want to work with me because I don't think I'm all one black person. I just say, oh, that's the left hand's problem. So now this guy keeps punching me here, and I'm only trying to defend with one hand. Look at how stupid that sounds. But that's the situation on the ground because we don't understand that we are all one black people, and we have common enemies.
But when you use Africa, yeah. Do you include from the Arab lands like Egypt, Morocco, Algeria? Because sometimes they don't claim that they are Africa.
Because they're not African. They are our first imperialists and our first invaders, and they are on occupied territory that they stole from black people. If you look, for example, at the original term for what they now call ancient Egypt, it was Kemet. That means land of black people. You understand? So if you go to the place that used to be called land of black people, you see nothing but Arabs. That should tell you something about the flow of history, that there were Hyksos, that there were Assyrians, that there were Persians, that there were Greeks, that there were Romans, that there were Arabs, so forth and so on, Mamluks, Vandals, all these invaders, and that's why that population looks the way that it looks. But when they depicted themselves as black people, and even better, they called themselves black people, that's the name of their land. Now you have white so-called pseudo-scholars who say, no, they were just saying that the soil is black. Well, in the people's own mythology, they say that they were made from that black soil. So now what do you have for me? So, you know, once we come to that understanding, we come to understand why they don't claim themselves as Africans, because they're not Africans, they're not black people. So even you had Gaddafi, who had this whole pan-Arabism agenda, and until that fell through, then he said, okay, let me try the dumb people, the African people, the black people, because they'll let me in. They don't know who they are. Look at Morocco, who just rejoined the AU. Haiti applied. Haiti was kept out. Pan-Africanism was developed with Haiti in mind. They mentioned Haiti specifically. They said Haiti, Liberia, Ethiopia, and any other countries that may come into existence at that point in time. We're talking about the 1900 conference, which put the term Pan-Africanism in the dictionary, right? Henry Sylvester Williams out of Trinidad. They were very clear that we're talking about black people no matter where we're located, right? But you have people who are in leadership positions who have no understanding of history, So therefore, Haiti applies. They say, no, you're one of us, but you're not African enough. Haiti is more African than all of Africa put together, right? And then Morocco applies, and then they open their arms wide and say, Morocco, come in. Morocco, who is still enslaving black people to this very day. Right now, what's the date? The 13th of June, according to this Gregorian calendar. Right now, they are enslaving black people. Right now, they are raping black people. Right now, they are killing black people. You understand? Because they know, even though black people don't know that they are our enemies, they know the history. They say, we Arabs have been fighting black people for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. We've been stealing their land for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Now, you black person, you don't know the history. You just walk into Morocco like, oh, my good buddies are Arabs. We're all Africans. But they know. And they give you that exact same treatment of someone who knows. So again, it comes down to, why are we kept in amnesia? Why do IMF and World Bank directives tell us not to know history? We can't teach history as a prerequisite to get this loan. Because they know, as long as you have people who are amnesiatic, that they never realize that this is the exact same thing that they did 10 years ago. This is the same thing they did 100 years ago. This is the same thing they did 1,000 years ago. You know, noted historian John Henry Clark, he talks about all history as a current event. He says what happened 5 minutes ago, 5 years ago, and 5,000 years ago tells us what will happen 5 minutes from now, 5 years from now, 5,000 years from now. All history is a current event, which means that if you know it, then you'll be able to see this pattern of this is just like the last time it happened. But imagine I'm a scientist, I'm doing experiments, and I don't know that the last time I mix these two chemicals, they exploded. So I go back into my lab, innocently, and I say, oh, I wonder what would happen if I mix those two chemicals. Boom, my head gets exploded off. This is our situation as African people, black people. And again, if you look at various African languages, the way that we understand Africanness, the way we conceptualize it in our own languages is always that those two are the same. African is black and black is African, right? So if you look at Chi, Obibini, that's the word for African. Bibi is also black. If you look at Yoruba, Adulawa, Du is black. If you talk about Africa, Ile, Adulawa, the land of those who are black in color. If you look at the Bambara language, Farafina, land of those who are black, right? If you look at Wolof, Reunikunyul, land of those who are black. If you look at Kikongo and Siabandombe, if you go to Kemet, land of black people, even if you go outside of African languages, look at the term Bilad al-Sudan, that's Arabic, they're saying land of black people. If you look at Greek, Ethiopia, Ethiops, they're saying these are the land of those who are burnt-faced. If you look at Latin, they're saying Niger, they're saying these are the black people. Everyone is clear that when we're talking about Africa, we're talking about land of black people. So to the exact extent that you have people who are not black on your land is the exact extent to which you need to go back and get those occupied lands and territories that have been stolen from us as black people.
Before your last words, can you just tell me, give me some words about the way of embracing Africa, clothing. I can see that you're wearing an African cloth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so all of this comes down to economic warfare, that if you realize that, you know, these pale white Eurasians are your enemy, then you start to look for ways that you can stop financing your enemy. You understand? If you look at how the transatlantic enslavement of African people was ended, that the first move was when there are several moves, all of them included black people killing white folks, but the most important one that ended chattel enslavement was when first Haiti beat France, which was supposed to be the most dominant military. Napoleon was going through beating all these white folks, but he couldn't beat the black people in Haiti because they realized that they're all black and they're going to fight like how black people fight. And then those same Haitians went on black people to liberate other countries with Simon Bolivar and others. But to come back to the point that after they defeated France, Britain also decided that they wanted to come and annex that as a colony. Now, after over 10,000 British were killed by those black people who knew who they were. That's when Britain decided, you know what, we have to abolish the quote-unquote slave trade, because from a military perspective, they realized that every single boat that lands is doing what? Supplying new troops to the enemies who they were just fighting and who just whooped their behinds mercilessly. So every single boat, you said, wow, that's a new army regiment for those black people. Another boat lands. So that's why they stopped the quote-unquote trade portion before the actual enslavement portion, because they were thinking like intelligent military strategists. Why am I going to reinforce my enemies there? And then you have the Samuel Sharp Rebellion in Jamaica, where again you had thousands of white people who were killed. And then within 1 week of them finally suppressing that rebellion, they got together a committee on ending the enslavement of black people altogether, because they realized that if they don't, they were going to get their butts whooped just like they did in Haiti. They were going to get their butts whooped just like they did in Jamaica. And they realized that, guess what? These black people can come to Britain. And the whole world can be Haiti. The whole world can be Jamaica. So, you know, again, to come back to our discussion, that at a certain point, you realize that you have to stop assisting your enemies. You understand? So in what you wear, anytime you go around Ghana and you see all these people wearing European clothes, you should think about it as a grant, as aid from Africa to white people, where you've given away multi-billions just from a choice, right? A so-called choice that's been manipulated, as we understand. But here's something that you could change if you're willing to take up responsibility and say the same, and however much the industry is worth, let's say the same $3 billion this year that we've sent to the US and to the UK and to France and to wherever else we're getting these clothes from, what could we have done with that same $3 billion here in Africa? I think that could pave some roads. I think that could keep some lights on. But we decided, again through manipulation, not to keep that money here and buy things that are made by and for African people. We say, let's go and send it out, because the same white people taught us that what our clothes are not good enough. They're not modern. This is another concept. All these euphemisms and synonyms for whitenization, they call it globalization, they call it modernism, they call it anything else. But what it is getting black people to act like white people, to ultimately enrich white people. So once you come to understand that, then you realize the choices that I make, it's not every single thing that black people make, but the things that we do make, let's support those economically and then spin that off into another industry. So let's just look at the clothes piece. If we all were wearing African clothes, think about the billions and billions and billions that would generate. In the next few years, we could be sending rocket ships up to space, right? Because we have the cash to do it. But right now, it's like trying to carry water in a basket. You keep putting water in, but it's shooting out of every side because there's nothing that's retaining it. Because, again, due to created tastes and desires, and again, our great African ancestor, Batao Tep, said, "One who listens to his belly belongs to the enemy." This was a warning from about 5,000 years ago, not to let other people, especially your enemies, dictate for you what you desire, what you like, right? Because if they do, you say, "Oh, I just want to wear this t-shirt." Well, who made that t-shirt? Who manufactured it? Where was the cotton grown? So even when we're talking about African clothes, there are levels to this. So when we're talking about something like the bogolan, that's what they call the mud cloth. So that is grown, the cotton is grown there in Mali, Burkina, those areas. Now they have the women who spin the cotton, and then you have the men who weave it together, and then they sew together the strips, and then they dye it with indigenous dyes from plants and other things. That's as African as you can get. There's nothing white in there. But now you can get to a lesser level of it and say, okay, well, let's look at some like Kente. Maybe they're importing rayon or importing some type of, you know, cotton or whatever to do it, or importing silk even to do it. And now they're doing, so they're still doing the weaving, they're still doing these other things, but it's not as much. So once we start thinking about this as economic warfare, then we start trying to reclaim areas that we don't yet have. So if we're not doing the threads, well, let's do the threads now. Let's go to that higher level. And then even lower than that, You could talk about the batiks and tie dyes. Even lower than that, you can talk about the wax prints, and even lower than that. So what we're trying to do is go towards what's more beneficial for African people. You understand that should be what we're looking at, because made by Africans, originated by Africans, for the benefit of Africans, that's the gold standard. Maybe we don't reach the gold standard in all areas, but that's what we should be aspiring towards. If we're doing that, then guess what? Our enemies are in trouble, because we're actually doing what's necessary to free ourselves from them. And that's also why you don't find many people doing that, because we're also always inundated with thoughts and ideas and advertising and everything else to prevent us from even wanting to.
Okay. Your last words.
last words. Black people, we don't have any allies but ourselves. We are constantly looking to everybody else as, well, maybe the Arabs will be our allies. Well, maybe the Chinese, or maybe the Germans, or maybe USAID, or maybe UK, maybe France. That, you know, again, as the noted historian John Henry Clark said, that we number over a billion on the face of the planet. Who do we need to ally with other than ourselves? That once we understand this, that everybody with any sense on the planet, who's everybody except for us at this point, is down, they're interested in self-preservation. They're interested in doing what's necessary to make sure their progeny, that their descendants are able to survive and are able to thrive at the expense of every other people who are not thinking that way. So once we start to practice what, again, Dr. John Henry Clark referred to as the essential selfishness of survival, that's when we'll actually start doing better. That's when we'll actually start to see a change. So that's it.
Thank you very much for this rich, very rich interview.
No problem.
Thank you.